CJSF is diverse, independent, and yours. Uniquely curated programming by our hosts maintains an independent voice among the masses. You keep CJSF independent.
A teacher was recently forced to take down a poster in her classroom that said, "Everyone is welcome here." They said that was a divisive political statement. And you know what? From the fascist point of view, that is a divisive political statement, because their goal is to ensure that everybody is not welcome in this country. And it starts with this war in the classroom to teach kids that this is the new reality.
That's Jesse Hagopian, and this is Alternative Radio. I'm David Barsamian. This edition of AR features Jesse Hagopian on the war on education. The right-wing war on education is well documented. The battleground extends from elementary and middle school all the way up to Harvard and Columbia. Books have been cut from curricula and pulled from school library shelves. Teachers have been fired. Schools that teach critical race theory and diversity, equity, and inclusion are being threatened with defunding. The radical right wants to control what is being taught. They want to turn the educational system into an indoctrination machine. Their goal includes plans to abolish the Department of Education. Students who peacefully protest and exercise their First Amendment rights have been, in some cases, suspended, expelled, and even denied their diplomas. Some international students have had their visas canceled and may face deportation. Jesse Hagopian says, "What's at stake is the freedom to expose injustice and to tell the truth." Our guest today is Jesse Hagopian. He's a Seattle-based educator who has taught in public schools for over 20 years. He's the director of the Zinn Education Project's Teaching for Black Lives campaign. He is an editor of Rethinking Schools and the author of Teach Truth, The Struggle for Anti-Racist Education. He spoke at Socialism 2025 in Chicago in July. And now, Jesse Hagopian.
There is a war going on right now to eradicate ways of knowing that challenge power. And my book talks about this war, but it's not just about the repression, it's also about the resistance, both the brave resistance happening right now and the long legacy of the fight for black education and liberatory ways of knowing. You know, I just want to stress that because education at its best isn't just preparation for work under capitalism, it's preparation for freedom. We fight for schools that don't just sort and rank children, but help them build solidarity, that don't just serve a capitalist economy, but serve meeting human needs, and don't just enrich a few wealthy parasites, but actually expand our sense of belonging, our imagination, and help us build a world where nobody is disposable. And so I offer this talk today not just as political strategy for how to fight back against billionaires and white supremacists, but also as a fulfillment of my promise to my ancestors that I wouldn't lie about their experience and that I would share it with everyone that I could. The laws today are becoming so over the top. They're just so absurd. These laws that are being passed to regulate what we can think about, that really only the Onion can fully capture this situation. Did people see the Onion headline from a couple years ago? There's a photo of a black teacher at the head of the class. And it says, Teacher fired for breaking state's critical race theory law after telling students she's black. And then Seattle has a version of The Onion that might be even better. You guys read The Needling. The Needling had a picture of Governor Ron DeSantis from Florida, and the headline said, "Florida bans the letters LGBTQ from the alphabet." Right, and then the whole article is like quotes from Florida officials that leave out those letters. Never did much reading, right? But you know, the satire is barely distinguishable from the reality. I mean, the reality is more absurd than that. You have to think about what Florida is actually doing. Right now, the official state curriculum in Florida says that slavery is of, quote, personal benefit to black people. This is not in the Ku Klux Klan's youth handbook. This is in the official state curriculum. In Florida, they banned the AP African American Studies. We know that. But do people know that it's a felony if you get caught with a banned book in your classroom? It's a 5-year jail sentence with a $5,000 fine. They went so far as to banning the dictionary in one Florida school district because, after all, it does have the word transgender in it. It does have the word sex and racism. When I say that the reality is more absurd than The Onion can come up with, this is what I'm talking about. In Idaho, a teacher was recently forced to take down a poster in her classroom that said, "Everyone is welcome here." They said that was a divisive political statement. And you know what? From the fascist point of view, that is a divisive political statement because their goal is to ensure that everybody is not welcome in this country. And it starts with this war in the classroom to teach kids that this is the new reality. Across the country, kids have been banned from learning about the Tulsa Massacre, Japanese American incarceration during World War II. A study in the Washington Post back in 2022 showed that over 160 educators across the country had been fired or pushed out of their classroom for teaching about race, gender, or sexuality. And we know that number was low then, and it certainly has increased by a lot now. And we're talking about people like Amy D'Onofrio in Florida, who taught at Robert E. Lee High School. A high school named after a genocidal maniac who murdered more people than any war, than all the wars in U.S. history combined. A school named after a genocidal white supremacist, and she put up a sign in her classroom that said Black Lives Matter so that kids knew that in this hostile white supremacist space that this was a safe place for them. And she was fired for doing so and learned that she was fired by on the radio when she heard the governor say that they were going after her for her wokeness. You know, Matthew Hahn was fired in Tennessee for teaching an award-winning author, Ta-Nehisi Coates. You have James Whitfield, a black principal in Texas, who after George Floyd was murdered, sent out an email to his school community saying that systemic racism is alive and well. And he was pushed out. You have my friend Melissa Temple in Wisconsin. Incredible educator, veteran teacher, former editor with Rethinking Schools, who's teaching first grade. And her kids wanted to sing a song called Rainbow Land for the school musical. Highly subversive song. Okay, we're talking about a pop song by Miley Cyrus and Dolly Parton here, okay, that doesn't even mention LGBTQ plus people, but does say we should live in a world where we're all treated equally. And she thought they had the right to sing that song, even though the principal banned it and the school district backed up that ban. And so on her own time, on a Friday after school at home, On her private Twitter account, she tweets out, "I think they should have the right to sing this song." And she showed up for school on Monday, and there was a head of HR in the school office and a police officer that escorted her out of the building, and she never got to see her children again. Right? Those first graders, that relationship just severed. Fired. Still no longer teaching. When we say fascism is rising in this country, we've been knowing it before Trump got elected, because if you're in the education field, you saw how this was working. I call these efforts to ban honest education, to ban books, I call them truth crime laws, because they criminalize honest education. And we are bearing witness to an era in which teachers who allow students to learn about racial disparities stemming from the legacy of slavery and Jim Crow segregation can be charged with a truth crime. And a truth crime is any act of honest pedagogy in a jurisdiction where truthful teaching has been outlawed. And truth crime is probably best described as enforced disremembering. A truth crime law, then, is one that makes lying to children obligatory and effectively renders honest education illegal. And the goal of the enforcers of truth crime, in the end, is to make committing a truth crime literally impossible, because there will be no one left to learn the honest history and therefore no one left to teach it. And this requires rewriting the past so that it appears to justify the dramatic inequality that exists today and impedes the ability of those who have learned the revisionist history to imagine a future without oppression. And so who are these people that are fighting to impose truth crime on our schools? I call them uncritical race theorists. In the cacophony of today's political discourse, debates about critical race theory are ubiquitous. But what's not discussed, and what I believe must be studied, is uncritical race theory. And uncritical race theory is the term I'm developing here to define systems of belief that unquestionably subscribe to status quo ideas about race and ideas that reinforce the existing racial power relations. So when we talk about uncritical race theory, we're talking about ideas that deny that racism exists at all, or ideas that claim it primarily victimizes white people, or rejects any systemic or institutional analysis, and instead reduces racism to sporadic individual explanations. And describing people who accept the status quo beliefs of race as uncritical race theorists, I think, is important, because it helps us underscore that people opposing anti-racist education are not rejecting theory about race. You hear this a lot from the uncritical race theorists. They say, "We don't want these radical teachers imposing their theories on our children." And they do that to try to label us as using unsubstantiated theories, as if they didn't have a theory about race. They were the objective, neutral guardians of truth that have no theory about race. They just want to describe the world. But in fact, they have a highly developed theory of race. They just don't want their theory examined, because then we would see the origins of their theory lie in unsavory ideas like eugenics that have largely fallen out of favor. And so uncritical race theorists really demand an anodyne telling of American history, one that says that our country was delivered by the stork. And they'd rather not look into how the country was made, lest it offend delicate sensibilities. They tell themselves America doesn't fornicate, cuss, drink, brawl, abuse, exploit, lie, cheat, or steal. But as James Baldwin reminds us, people who shut their eyes to reality simply invite their own destruction. And anyone who insists on remaining in a state of innocence long after that innocence is dead turns himself into a monster. And let me give you some examples of uncritical race theory in action. We could start with Ted Cruz, who spoke at the Faith and Freedom Coalition not too long ago, and gripping the microphone, he bellowed, "Let me tell you right now that critical race theory is bigoted, it's a lie, and it's every bit as racist as the Klansmen in white sheets." I want us to sit with that for a second and just think about the argument he's making. He is saying that the teachers who want to teach about the KKK mass terrorist organization that killed thousands and lynched and maimed people are the same as the organization that actually did that murder and torture, right? This is the level of intellectual sophistication we're dealing with here with these uncritical race theorists, right? And it's not just right-wingers who are uncritical race theorists. We should be very clear that liberals are also uncritical race theorists. And I think that's why I think this term is useful, because we need to understand that there's a lot of overlap between liberals and conservatives when they analyze how race works in our society. Liberals tend to gravitate toward another tenet of uncritical race theory, which is the colorblind analysis, right? So when you remember when Obama got elected and everyone was screaming about the post-racial society we were living in, you had people like MSNBC hosts that were saying, I almost forgot Obama was black for the last hour while he was talking, right? The colorblind analysis from liberals have really opened the door to conservatives imposing even more openly hateful ideology. And, you know, in June 2024, we got another lesson in uncritical race theory from Trump, who was dismissed concerns about George Washington enslaving black people at the Faith and Freedom Coalition. He said, you know, they thought he had slaves. Actually, he probably didn't. Therein lies the essence of uncritical race theory, a calculated farce that prefers comforting delusions over the cotton-picking truth that George Washington owned 123 black people, adding 153 more through marriage to Martha. And, you know, Trump believes that the dishonesty to children about America's past is essential, because if students understand that this country was founded on the genocide of Native Americans and the enslavement of black people, they might begin to question our country, the foundations, the origins, and today's unequal distribution of resources and power. And as a teacher for the last 20 years, I've guided my students not only in assessing our nation through the eyes of George Washington, but also through the perspective of Ona Judge, who was an enslaved black woman who bravely escaped George Washington's forced labor camp. And I've always encouraged my students to think critically, to question everything, including me, including the sources that I'm bringing to them in the classroom, and refuse to exclude the role of race in U.S. history as part of their inquiry. That is what black studies and ethnic studies and critical race theory and cultural studies and other traditions of resistance bring to education. And in the boundless satire that is the United States of America, we have a situation today where the oldest commemoration of the end of slavery, Juneteenth, became a federal holiday at the same time it became illegal to talk about where the holiday came from and why we needed it. And the land of the free just continues to take on new and intricate shades of mockery as more and more educators are fired or pushed out. And we're seeing one of the sharpest edges of this attack being inflicted on LGBTQ plus students, especially trans students right now. in a practice I call in the book educational closeting. And in March of 2022, Ron DeSantis passed the Parental Rights in Education Bill, better known as the Don't Say Gay Bill, which prohibits classrooms instruction related to LGBTQ issues. And then he banned AP African American Studies. And do people remember the justification he gave for banning it? He said, quote, "This course on Black history, what's one of the lessons about? Queer theory. Now, who would say that that is an important part of Black history? Is somebody pushing an agenda on our, that is somebody pushing an agenda on our kids, right? Who would say that queer theory is an important part of Black history? Lorraine Hansberry, James Baldwin, Pauli Murray, Audre Lorde, Ma Rainey, Bessie Smith, Bayard Rustin, Marsha P. Johnson. I mean, we could go on and on and on. You cannot understand the Black experience and the Black rebellion without understanding it intersectionally with queer and women's history. And educational closeting was just intensified in this country on June 27th when the Supreme Court handed down a chilling 6-3 decision in Muhammad versus Taylor, siding with a group of parents in Maryland who demanded that public schools allow them to opt their children out of any lesson containing LGBTQ plus characters or themes. And Chase Strangio for the UCLA explained it like this, quote, "What's chilling about this case from the 6-3 majority is the way in which they talk about LGBTQ people. They cast these books as coercive simply because they have LGBT characters. We should follow also this court that has continually cast LGBTQ people as a viewpoint and as an ideology, not as a community that exists." We should know this isn't the first time that queer people have come under severe attack in the education system. During the late 40s and early 50s, the McCarthyist Red Scare drove thousands of teachers out of the profession. Over 400 teachers in New York City alone were fired under suspicion of being communist. But what is less studied is the overlapping Lavender Scare that occurred at the same time, and actually more federal employees were fired under suspicion of being homosexual than they were of being members of the Communist Party. And in Florida, they enacted what was called the Johns Committee. And this committee first was started to attack any kind of racial justice movements, especially educators who were teaching about racial justice or the Black freedom struggle. Any teacher who had affiliation with the NAACP was attacked by the Johns Committee, but it quickly turned its mission into fighting against LGBTQ plus educators, and especially single women were brought before the Johns Committee and had their sex lives interrogated. Hundreds were fired under suspicion of being lesbians. This is the playbook that the current uncritical race theorists and educational closeters are drawing from. And they have three major goals, I believe, with this attack on education. And I want to outline the three major goals they have, because I think that most of the discussion in the mainstream today is limited to only the first goal I'm going to lay out here. But it goes much deeper than that. The first goal is to attack public education, to attack anti-racist education in order to win elections, right? And we saw the way in the 2022 midterms and in the most recent presidential election, they instilled fear in white families that schools were designed to shame their white children and that they should vote for the GOP because they were going to protect your white family from these attacks, right? And so they were used successfully to drive white families to the polls to vote for Republican candidates. But when you read about it in the mainstream media, that's the only reason that's given for why they are attacking anti-racist education. And it's much deeper than that, because the next level of it is the drive for privatization. They have been trying to figure out for a long time how to privatize the public school system. You know, the libraries and the public schools are some of the last institutions we have that are free and open to the public, and they want to profit off of that. This is capitalism. You can't just be giving things away. I mean, it's our labor that's paying for the taxes that is paying for the schools, but in their minds, it's just giving it away. And so if you can convince families that their children are being shamed by social justice, anti-racist teachers, you can drive them out of the public schools and convince them to move to charters or use voucher school programs and begin to dismantle the public schools. And we know that the language of school choice that's used with charter schools and voucher schools came from the massive resistance movement against integrating schools. It came from the segregationists opposing Brown versus Board of Education. So this is definitely one of the main strategies they have for privatizing the public schools, but that's not the end of it. That is definitely a major goal. But I want us to look deeper than that and to understand the long history of the attack on Black education, on anti-racist education, on indigenous education. Because they've always known that they have to destroy entire systems of knowledge, especially those rooted in history and wisdom of oppressed people. They can't maintain a system this unequal if people understand where that inequality came from, where the wealth in society is produced, and who is profiting off of that and who is not. And so they want to impose epistemicide, right? The murder of ways of knowing, the murder of knowledge, as a way to maintain their power. And that became a crucial political strategy in the wake of the 2020 uprising. Racists got scared, y'all. I mean, you need to understand that that was the most number of people protesting in U.S. history. The New York Times said over 20 million people marched in every single state in the country demanding radical reform. I would argue that the biggest place that the 2020 uprising had concrete policy impacts was in education. And we won ethnic studies programs and Black studies programs, and every New York Times bestseller book was an anti-racist title, and this freaked uncritical race theorists out. And they knew that it was time to be more forceful in the quest for epistemicide. Usually they're content with the hidden curriculum. Usually they're content with erasing our stories out of the corporate textbooks and then mandating we teach from these and then hiding our history that way. But when this mass rebellion revealed the truth about this country and people started learning about the Tulsa massacre and the true history of this country, they had to revert to more overt attacks. And that's when billionaires felt threatened and got involved. And I write about that in the chapter called The Political Economy of Truth Crime. And in the mainstream telling of this attack on anti-racist education, they say that, well, during COVID, families got to see what their children were learning on Zoom, and they were horrified by the shaming of their children, and a grassroots movement was born to defend education. The piece they left out there was white families. They don't usually like to use the descriptor there. And then the other piece they left out was a very small minority of white families who were funded by billionaires, not quite your vision of grassroots. So we can talk about Julie Fancelli, who is the Publix grocer fortune head, and financed the January 6th uprising, who spent tens of thousands of dollars to organizations promoting book bans. Or we can talk about Betsy DeVos, former education secretary, Amway billionaire.